Side 3.
Chapter 15. The restaurant at the end of the universe is one of the most extraordinary ventures in the entire history of catering. It has been built on the fragmented remains of... It will be built on the fragmented... That is to say, it will have been built by this time, and indeed has been... One of the major problems encountered in time travel is not that of accidentally becoming your own father or mother. There is no problem involved in becoming your own father or mother that a broad-minded and well-adjusted family can't cope with. There is also no problem about changing the course of history. The course of history does not change because it all fits together like a jigsaw. All the important changes have happened before the things they were supposed to change, and it all sorts itself out in the end. The major problem is quite simply one of grammar. And the main work to consult in this matter is Dr. Dan Streetmenschner's Time Traveller's Handbook of 1001 Tense Formations. It will tell you, for instance, how to describe something that was about to happen to you in the past before you avoided it by time-jumping forward 2 days in order to avoid it. The event will be described differently according to whether you are talking about it from the standpoint of your own natural time, from a time in the further future, or a time in the further past, and is further complicated by the possibility of conducting conversations whilst you are actually travelling from one time to another with the intention of becoming your own mother or father. Most readers get as far as the future semi-conditionally modified sub-inverted plagal past subjunctive intentional before giving up. And in fact, in later editions of the book, all pages beyond this point have been left blank to save on printing costs. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy skips lightly over this tangle of academic abstraction, pausing only to note that the term future perfect has been abandoned since it was discovered not to be. To resume. The restaurant at the end of the universe is one of the most extraordinary ventures in the entire history of catering. It is built on the fragmented remains of an eventually ruined planet which is, or we all haven't be, enclosed in a vast time bubble and projected forward in time to the precise moment of the end of the universe. This is, many would say, impossible. In it, guests take, willen on take, their places at table and eat, willen on eat, sumptuous meals whilst watching, willing watchin', the whole of creation explode around them. This, many would say, is equally impossible. You can arrive, may an arrive and on when, for any sitting you like without prior, late for when, reservation, because you can book retrospectively, as it were, when you return to your own time. You can have on book have enter for when presooning returning winter retro home. This is, many would now insist, absolutely impossible. At the restaurant you can meet and dine with, may an meet and con with dine and on when, a fascinating cross-section of the entire population of space and time. This, it can be explained patiently, is also impossible. You can visit it as many times as you like, mayen on visit, re on visiting, and so on. For further tense correction, consult Dr. Streetmenschner's book. And be sure of never meeting yourself because of the embarrassment this usually causes. This, even if the rest were true, which it isn't, is patently impossible, say the doubters. All you have to do is to deposit one penny in a savings account in your own era, and when you arrive at the end of time, the operation of compound interest means that the fabulous cost of your meal has been paid for. This, many claim, is not merely impossible, but clearly insane, which is why the advertising executives of the star system of Bastablon came up with this slogan. If you've done six impossible things this morning, why not round it off with breakfast at Milliways, the restaurant at the end of the universe? Chapter 16. At the bar, Zayford was rapidly becoming as tired as a newt. His heads knocked together and his smiles were coming out of sync. He was miserably happy. Zayford, said Ford, whilst you're still capable of speech, would you care to tell me what the photon happened? Where have you been? Where have we been? Small matter, but I'd like it cleared up. Zayford's left head sobered up, leaving his right to sink further into the obscurity of drink. Yeah, he said, I've been around. They want me to find the man who rules the universe, but I don't care to meet him. I believe the man can't cook. His left head watched his right head saying this and then nodded. True, it said. Have another drink. Ford had another pangalactic gargle blaster, the drink which has been described as the alcoholic equivalent of a mugging, expensive and bad for the head. Whatever had happened, Ford decided, he didn't really care too much. Listen, Ford, said Zaphod, everything's cool and fruity.
You mean everything's under control?
No, said Zaphod, I do not mean everything's under control. That would not be cool and fruity. If you want to know what happened, let's just say I had the whole situation in my pocket, okay?
Ford shrugged. Zaphod giggled into his drink. It frothed up over the side of the glass and started to eat its way into the marble bar top. A wild-skinned sky gypsy approached them and played electric violin at them until Zaphod gave him a lot of money and he agreed to go away again. The gypsy approached Arthur and Trillian, sitting in another part of the bar.
"I don't know what this place is," said Arthur, "but I think it gives me the creeps."
"Have another drink," said Trillian. "Enjoy yourself."
"Which?" said Arthur. "The two are mutually exclusive."
"Poor Arthur. You're not really cut out for this life, are you?"
"You call this life?"
"You're beginning to sound like Marvin. Marvin's the clearest thinker I know. How do you think we make this violinist go away?"
The waiter approached. "Your table is ready," he said.
Seen from the outside, which it never is, the restaurant resembles a giant, glittering starfish beached on a forgotten rock. Each of its arms house the bars, the kitchens, the force field generators which protect the entire structure and the decayed hunk of planet on which it sits, and the time turbines which slowly rock the whole affair backwards and forwards across the crucial moment. In the centre sits the gigantic golden dome, almost a complete globe. And it was into this area that Zaphod, Ford, Arthur and Trillian now passed. At least 5 tons of glitter alone had gone into it before them and covered every available surface. The other surfaces were not available because they were already encrusted with jewels, precious seashells from Santragenus, gold leaf, mosaic tiles, lizard skins, and a million unidentifiable embellishments and decorations. Glass glittered, silver shone, gold gleamed, Arthur Dent goggled.
"Wowee," said Zaphod, "Zappo!"
"Incredible," breathed Arthur. "The people, the things."
"The things," said Ford Prefect quietly, "are also people."
"The people," resumed Arthur, "the other people." "The lights," said Trillian. "The tables," said Arthur. "The clothes," said Trillian.
The waiter thought they sounded like a couple of bailiffs.
"The end of the universe is very popular," said Zaphod, threading his way unsteadily through the throng of tables, some made of marble, some of rich ultra-mahogany, some even of platinum, and at each a party of exotic creatures chatting amongst themselves and studying menus.
People like to dress up for it," continued Zaphod. "Gives it a sense of occasion."
The tables were fanned out in a large circle around a central stage area where a small band was playing light music. At least 1,000 tables was Arthur's guess. And interspersed among them were swaying palms, hissing fountains, grotesque statuary, in short, all the paraphernalia common to all restaurants where little expense has been spared to give the impression that no expense has been spared. Arthur glanced around, half expecting to see someone making an American Express commercial. Zaphod lurched into Ford, who lurched back into Zaphod.
"Wowee," said Zaphod. "Zappo," said Ford.
"My great-granddaddy must have really screwed up the computer's works, you know," said Zaphod. "I told it to take us to the nearest place to eat, and it sends us to the end of the universe. Remind me to be nice to it one day."
He paused.
"Hey, everybody's here, you know. Everybody who was anybody."
"Was?" said Arthur.
"Well, at the end of the universe, you have to use the past tense a lot," said Zaphod, "because everything's been done, you know. Hi, guys," he called out to a nearby party of giant iguana life forms. "How did you do?"
"Is that Zaphod Beeblebrox?" asked one iguana of another iguana.
"I think so," replied the second iguana. "Well, doesn't that just take that biscuit?" said the first iguana.
"Funny old thing, life," said the second iguana.
It's what you make it, said the first, and they lapsed back into silence. They were waiting for the greatest show in the universe.
Hey, Zaphod, said Ford, grabbing for his arm, and on account of the third pangalactic gargle blaster missing, he pointed a swaying finger. There's an old mate of mine, he said. Hot Black Desiato. See the man at the platinum table with the platinum suit on?
Zaphod tried to follow Ford's fingers with his eyes, but it made him feel dizzy. Finally, he saw.
Oh, yeah, he said.
Then recognition came a moment later.
Hey, he said. Did that guy ever make it mega big? Wow, bigger than the biggest thing ever, other than me.
Who's he supposed to be? Asked Trillian.
Hot Black Desiato, said Zaphod in astonishment. You don't know? You never heard of Disaster Area?
No, said Trillian, who hadn't.
The biggest, said Ford, loudest, richest, suggested Zaphod. Rock band and the history of...
He searched for the word.
History itself, said Zaphod.
No, said Trillian.
Zowie, said Zaphod. Here we are at the end of the universe and you haven't even lived yet. Did you miss out?
He led her off to where the waiter had been waiting all this time at the table. Arthur followed them, feeling very lost and alone. Ford waded off through the throng to renew an old acquaintance.
Hey, Hot Black, he called out. How you doing? Great to see you, big boy. How's the noise? You're looking great. Really very, very fat and unwell. Amazing.
He slapped the man on the back and was mildly surprised that it seemed to elicit no response. The pangalactic gargle blaster swilling around inside him told him to plunge on regardless.
Remember the old days, he said, we used to hang out, right? The Bistro Illegal, remember? Slim's Throat Emporium, the evil drone Boozerama, great days, eh?
Hot Black Desiato offered no opinion as to whether they were great days or not. Ford was not perturbed.
And when we were hungry, you'd pose as public health inspectors, you remember that? And go around confiscating meals and drinks, right, till we got food poisoning. Oh, and then there were the long nights of talking and drinking in those smelly rooms above the Café Lou in Gretchentown, New Beetle. And you were always in the next room trying to write songs on your adjutar, and we all hated them. And you said you didn't care, and we said we did because we hated them so much.
Ford's eyes were beginning to mist over.
And you said... You didn't want to be a star, he continued, wallowing in nostalgia, because you despised the star system. And we said, you know, Hadra and Sully Joe and me, we said that we didn't think you had the option. And what do you do now? You buy star systems.
He turned and solicited the attention of those at nearby tables.
Here, he said, is a man who buys star systems.
Hot Black Desiato made no attempt either to confirm or deny this fact. And the attention of the temporary audience waned rapidly.
I think somebody's drunk, muttered a purple bush-like being into his wine glass.
Ford staggered slightly and sat down heavily on the chair facing Hot Black Desiato.
What's that number you do? He said,
unwisely grabbing at a bottle for support and tipping it over into a nearby glass, as it happened. Not to waste a happy accident, he drained the glass.
That really huge number, he continued. How does it go? Blam, blam, ba-da! Something. And in the stage act, you do it. It ends up with a ship crashing right into the sun, and you actually do it.
Ford crashed his fist into his other hand to illustrate this feat graphically. He knocked the bottle over again.
Ship, sun, wham, bang, he cried. I mean, forget lasers and stuff. You guys are in a solar flares and real sunburn. Oh, and terrible songs.
His eyes followed the stream of liquid glugging out of the bottle on the table. Something ought to be done about it, he thought.
Hey, you want a drink, he said.
It began to sink into his squelching mind that something was missing from this reunion, and that the missing something was in some way connected with the fact that the fat man sitting opposite him in the platinum suit and the silvery trilby had not yet said, Hi, Ford, or Great to see you after all this time, or in fact, anything at all. More to the point, he'd not even moved.
Hot Black, said Ford.
A large, meaty hand landed on his shoulder from behind and pushed him aside. He slid gracelessly off his seat, and peered upwards to see if he could spot the owner of this discourteous hand. The owner was not hard to spot, on account of his being something of the order of 7 feet tall, and not slightly built with it. In fact, he was built the way one builds leather sofas, shiny, lumpy, and with lots of solid stuffing. The suit into which the man's body had been stuffed looked as if its only purpose in life was to demonstrate how difficult it was to get this sort of body into a suit. The face had the texture of an orange, and the colour of an apple, but there the resemblance to anything sweet ended.
"Kid,"
said a voice which emerged from the man's mouth as if it had been having a really rough time down in his chest.
Yeah?
Said Ford conversationally. He staggered back to his feet again and was disappointed that the top of his head didn't come further up the man's body.
"Beat it,"
said the man.
"Oh, yeah?"
said Ford, wondering how wise he was being. "And who are you?" The man considered this for a moment. He wasn't used to being asked this sort of question. Nevertheless, after a while, he came up with an answer.
"I'm the guy who's telling you to beat it," he said, "before you get it beaten for you."
"Now listen," said Ford nervously. He wished his head would stop spinning, settle down and get to grips with the situation. "Now listen," he continued. "I am one of Hot Black's oldest friends, and..." He glanced at Hot Black Desiato, who still hadn't moved as much as an eyelash. "And," said Ford again, wondering what would be a good word to say after "and." The large man came up with a whole sentence to go after "and." He said it.
"And I am Mr. Desiato's bodyguard," it went. "And I am responsible for his body, and I am not responsible for yours, so take it away before it gets damaged."
"Now wait a minute," said Ford.
"No minutes," said the bodyguard. "No waiting. Mr. Desiato speaks to no one."
"Well, perhaps you'd let him say what he thinks about the matter himself," said Ford.
"He speaks to no one," bellowed the bodyguard.
Ford glanced anxiously at Hot Black again and was forced to admit to himself that the bodyguard did seem to have facts on his side. There was still not the slightest sign of movement, let alone keen interest in Ford's welfare. "Why," said Ford, "what's the matter with him?" The bodyguard told him. Chapter 17. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy notes that Disaster Area, a plutonium rock band from the Gagrakaka mine zones, are generally held to be not only the loudest rock band in the galaxy, but in fact the loudest noise of any kind at all. Regular concertgoers judge that the best sound balance is usually to be heard from within large concrete bunkers some 37 miles from the stage, whilst the musicians themselves play their instruments by remote control from within a heavily insulated spaceship which stays in orbit around the planet, or, more frequently, around a completely different planet. Their songs are, on the whole, very simple, and mostly follow the familiar theme of boy-being meets girl-being beneath a silvery moon, which then explodes for no adequately explored reason. Many worlds have now banned their act altogether, sometimes for artistic reasons, but most commonly because the band's public address system contravenes local strategic arms limitations treaties. This has not, however, stopped their earnings from pushing back the boundaries of pure hypermathematics, and their chief research accountant has recently been appointed Professor of Neo-Mathematics at the University of Maximegalon, in recognition of both his general and his special theories of disaster area tax returns, in which he proves that the whole fabric of the space-time continuum is not merely curved, it is in fact totally bent. Ford staggered back to the table where Zaphod, Arthur and Trillian were sitting waiting for the fun to begin.
"Gotta have some food," said Ford.
"Hi, Ford," said Zaphod. "You speak to the big noise boy?" Ford waggled his head noncommittally.
"Hot Black? I sort of spoke to him, yeah."
"What did he say?"
"Well, not a lot, really.
Yeah?
He's spending a year dead for tax reasons. I've got to sit down."
He sat down. The waiter approached. "Oh, would you like to see the menu?" he said, "or would you like to meet the dish of the day?"
"Huh?" said Ford.
"Huh?"
said Arthur.
"Huh?"
said Trillian.
"Oh, that's cool," said Zaphod. "We'll meet the meat." In a small room in one of the arms of the restaurant complex, a tall, thin, gangling figure pulled aside a curtain, and oblivion looked him in the face. It was not a pretty face. Perhaps because oblivion had looked him in it so many times. It was too long for a start, the eyes too sunken and hooded, the cheeks too hollow. His lips were too thin and too long, and when they parted, his teeth looked too much like a recently polished bay window. The hands that held the curtain were long and thin too. They were also cold. They lay lightly along the folds of the curtain, and gave the impression that if you didn't watch them like a hawk, they would crawl away of their own accord and do something unspeakable in a corner. He let the curtain drop, and the terrible light that played on his features went off to play somewhere more healthy. He prowled around his small chamber like a mantis contemplating an evening's praying, finally settling in a rickety chair by a trestle table, where he leafed through a few sheets of jokes. A bell rang. He pushed the thin sheaf of papers aside and stood up. His hands brushed limply over some of the 1,000,000 rainbow-coloured sequins with which his jacket was festooned, and he was gone through the door. In the restaurant, the lights dimmed. The band quickened its pace. A single spotlight stabbed down into the darkness of the stairway that led up to the centre of the stage. Up the stairs bounded a tall, brilliantly coloured figure. He burst onto the stage, tripped lightly up to the microphone, removed it from its stand with one swoop of his long, thin hand, and stood for a moment bowing left and right to the audience, acknowledging their applause and displaying to them his bay window. He waved to his particular friends in the audience, even though there weren't any there, and waited for the applause to die down. He held up his hand and smiled a smile that stretched not merely from ear to ear, but seemed to extend some way beyond the mere confines of his face. "Thank you, ladies and gentlemen," he cried. "Thank you very much. Thank you so very much." He eyed them with a twinkling eye. "Ladies and gentlemen," he said, "the universe as we know it has now been in existence for over 170,000 million billion years and will be ending in a little over half an hour. So welcome, one and all, to Milliways, the restaurant at the end of the universe." With a gesture, he deftly conjured another round of spontaneous applause. With another gesture, he cut it. "I am your host for tonight," he said. "My name is Max Quadlepleen." Everybody knew this. His act was famous throughout the known galaxy, but he said it for the fresh applause it generated, which he acknowledged with a disclaiming smile and wave. "And I've just come straight from the very, very other end of time, where I've been hosting a show at the Big Bang Burger Bar, where I can tell you we had a very exciting evening, ladies and gentlemen, and I will be with you right through this historic occasion, the end of history itself." Another burst of applause died away quickly as the lights dimmed down further. On every table, candles ignited themselves spontaneously, eliciting a slight gasp from all the diners and wreathing them in 1,000 tiny flickering lights and 1,000,000 intimate shadows. A tremor of excitement thrilled through the darkened restaurant as the vast golden dome above them began very, very slowly to dim, to darken, to fade. Max's voice was hushed as he continued. "So, ladies and gentlemen," he breathed, "the candles are lit, the band plays softly, and as the force-shielded dome above us fades into transparency, revealing a dark and sullen sky hung with the ancient light of livid, swollen stars, I can see we're all in for a fabulous evening's apocalypse." Even the soft tootling of the band faded away, a stunned shock descended on all those who had not seen this sight before. A monstrous, grisly light poured in on them. A hideous light. A boiling, pestilential light. A light that would have disfigured hell. The universe was coming to an end. For a few interminable seconds, the restaurant spun silently through the raging void. Then Max spoke again. "For those of you who ever hoped to see the light at the end of the tunnel," he said, "this is it." The band struck up again. "Thank you, ladies and gentlemen," cried Max. "I'll be back with you again in just a moment. And meanwhile, I'll leave you in the very capable hands of Mr. Reg Nullify and his cataclysmic combo. Big hand, ladies and gentlemen, for Reg and the boys." The baleful turmoil of the skies continued. Hesitantly, the audience began to clap. And after a moment or so, normal conversation resumed. Max began his round of the table, swapping jokes, shouting with laughter, earning his living. A large dairy animal approached Zaphod Beeblebrox's table. A large, fat, meaty quadruped of the bovine type, with large, watery eyes, small horns, and what might almost have been an ingratiating smile on its lips. "Good evening," it lowed, and sat back heavily on its haunches. "I am the main dish of the day.
May I interest you in parts of my body? It harrumphed and gurgled a bit, wriggled its hindquarters into a more comfortable position, and gazed peacefully at them. Its gaze was met by looks of startled bewilderment from Arthur and Trillian, a resigned shrug from Ford Prefect, and naked hunger from Zaphod Beeblebrox.
Something off the shoulder, perhaps, suggested the animal, braised in a white wine sauce.
Your shoulder?
Said Arthur in a horrified whisper.
But naturally my shoulder, sir, mooed the animal contentedly. Nobody else's is mine to offer.
Zaphod leapt to his feet and started prodding and feeling the animal's shoulder appreciatively.
Or the rump is very good, murmured the animal. I've been exercising it and eating plenty of grain, so there's a lot of good meat there.
It gave a mellow grunt, gurgled again, and started to chew the cud. It swallowed the cud again.
Or a casserole of me, perhaps, it added.
You mean this animal actually wants us to eat it?
Whispered Trillian to Ford.
Me, said Ford, with a glazed look in his eyes. I don't mean anything.
That's absolutely horrible, exclaimed Arthur. That's the most revolting thing I've ever heard.
What's the problem, Earthman? Said Zaphod, now transferring his attention to the animal's enormous rump.
I just don't want to eat an animal that's standing there inviting me to, said Arthur. It's heartless.
Better than eating an animal that doesn't want to be eaten, said Zaphod.
That's not the point, Arthur protested.
Then he thought about it for a moment.
Right, he said, maybe it is the point. I don't care. I'm not going to think about it now. I'll just,
The universe raged about him in its death throes.
I think I'll just have a green salad, he muttered.
May I urge you to consider my liver? Asked the animal. It must be very rich and tender by now. I've been force-feeding myself for months.
A green salad, said Arthur emphatically.
A green salad, said the animal,
rolling his eyes disapprovingly at Arthur.
Are you going to tell me, said Arthur, that I shouldn't have a green salad?
Well, said the animal, I know many vegetables that are very clear on that point, which is why it was eventually decided to cut through the whole tangled problem and breed an animal that actually wanted to be eaten and was capable of saying so clearly and distinctly. And here I am.
It managed a very slight bow.
Glass of water, please, said Arthur.
Look, said Zaphod, we want to eat. We don't want to make a meal of the issues. Four rare steaks, please, and hurry. We haven't eaten in 576,000 million years.
The animal staggered to its feet. It gave a mellow gurgle.
A very wise choice, sir, if I may say so.
Very good, it said.
I'll just nip off and shoot myself.
He turned and gave a friendly wink to Arthur.
Don't worry, sir, he said. I'll be very humane.
It waddled unhurriedly off to the kitchen. A matter of minutes later, the waiter arrived with four huge steaming steaks. Zaphod and Ford wolfed straight into them without a second's hesitation. Trillian paused, then shrugged and started into hers. Arthur stared at his, feeling slightly ill.
"Hey, Earthman," said Zaphod, with a malicious grin on the face that wasn't stuffing itself. "What's eating you?"
And the band played on.
All around the restaurant, people and things relaxed and chatted. The air was filled with talk of this and that, and with the mingled scents of exotic plants, extravagant foods, and insidious wines. For an infinite number of miles in every direction, the universal cataclysm was gathering to a stupefying climax. Glancing at his watch, Max returned to the stage with a flourish.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, he beamed, is everyone having one last wonderful time?
Yes, called out the sort of people who called out yes when comedians ask them if they're having a wonderful time.
That's wonderful, enthused Max. Absolutely wonderful. And as the photon storms gather in swirling crowds around us, preparing to tear apart the last of the red-hot suns, I know you're all going to want to settle back and enjoy with me what I know we will all find an immensely exciting and terminal experience.
He paused. He caught the audience with a glittering eye.
Believe me, ladies and gentlemen, he said, there is nothing penultimate about this one.
He paused again. Tonight his timing was immaculate. Time after time he had done the show, night after night. Not that the word night had any meaning here at the extremity of time. All there was the endless repetition of the final moment as the restaurant rocked slowly forward over the brink of time's furthest edge and back again. This night was good, though. The audience was writhing in the palm of his sickly hand. His voice dropped. They had to strain to hear him. "This," he said, "really is the absolute end, the final chilling desolation in which the whole majestic sweep of creation becomes extinct. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the proverbial it." He dropped his voice to lower. In the stillness, a fly would not have dared clear its throat. "After this," he said, "there is nothing. Void, emptiness, oblivion, absolute nothing." His eyes glittered again, or did they twinkle? "Nothing, except, of course, for the sweet trolley and a fine selection of Aldebaran liqueurs." The band gave him a musical sting. He wished they wouldn't. He didn't need it. Not an artist of his caliber. He could play the audience like his own musical instrument. They were laughing with relief. He followed on. "And for once," he cried cheerily, "you don't have to worry about having a hangover in the morning, because there won't be any more mornings." He beamed at his happy, laughing audience. He glanced up at the sky, going through the same death routine every night. But his glance was only for a fraction of a second. He trusted it to do its job, as one professional trusts another. "And now," he said, strutting about the stage, "at the risk of putting a damper on the wonderful sense of doom and futility here this evening, I would like to welcome a few parties." He pulled a card from his pocket. "Do we have," he put up a hand to hold back the cheers, "do we have a party here from the Zansel Quasia Flammarion Bridge Club from beyond the Vort Void of Kwan? Are they here?" A routine cheer came from the back, but he pretended not to hear. He peered around trying to find them. "Are they here?" he asked again, to elicit a louder cheer. He got it, as he always did. "Ah, there they are. Well, last bids, lads, and no cheating. Remember, this is a very solemn moment." He lapped up the laughter. "And do we have a party of minor deities from the halls of Asgard?" Away to his right came a rumble of thunder. Lightning arced across the stage. A small group of hairy men with helmets sat looking very pleased with themselves and raised their glasses to him. "Has-beens," he thought to himself. "Careful with that hammer, sir," he said. They did their trick with the lightning again. Max gave them a very thin-lipped smile. "And thirdly," he said, "thirdly, a party of young conservatives from Sirius B. Are they here?" A party of smartly dressed young dogs stopped throwing rolls at each other and started throwing rolls at the stage. They yapped and barked unintelligibly. "Yes," said Maxwell, "this is all your fault. You realize that?" "And finally," said Max, quietening the audience down and putting on his solemn face, "finally, I believe we have with us here tonight a party of believers, very devout believers, from the Church of the Second Coming of the Great Prophet Zarquan." There were about 20 of them, sitting right out on the edge of the floor, ascetically dressed, sipping mineral water nervously and staying apart from the festivities. They blinked resentfully as the spotlight was turned on them. "There they are," said Max, "sitting there patiently. He said he'd come again and he's kept you waiting a long time, so let's hope he's hurrying, fellas, because he's only got 8 minutes left." The party of Zarquan's followers sat rigid, refusing to be buffeted by the waves of uncharitable laughter which swept over them. Max restrained his audience. "No, but seriously though, folks, seriously though, no offence meant. No, I know we shouldn't make fun of deeply held beliefs, so I think a big hand, please, for the great prophet Zarquan." The audience clapped respectfully. "Wherever he's got to!" He blew a kiss to the stony-faced party and returned to the centre of the stage. He grabbed a tall stool and sat on it. "It's marvellous, though," he rattled on, "to see so many of you here tonight. No, isn't it, though? Yes, absolutely marvellous, because I know that so many of you come here time and time again, which I think is really wonderful, to come and watch this final end of everything and then return home to your own eras and raise families, strive for new and better societies, fight terrible wars for you. You know to be right. It really gives one hope for the future of all life kind. Except, of course," he waved at the blitzing turmoil above and around them, "that we know it hasn't got one." Arthur turned to Ford. He hadn't quite got this place worked out in his mind. "Look, surely," he said, "if the universe is about to end, don't we go with it?" Ford gave him a 3-pan galactic gargle blaster look.
In other words, a rather unsteady one. No, he said. Look, he said, as soon as you come into this dive, you get held in this sort of amazing force-shielded temporal warp thing, I think. Oh, said Arthur. He turned his attention back to a bowl of soup he'd managed to get from the waiter to replace his steak. Look, said Ford, I'll show you. He grabbed at a napkin off the table and fumbled hopelessly with it. Look, he said, imagine this napkin, right, as the temporal universe, right? And the spoon as a transductional mode in the matter curve. It took him a while to say this last part, and Arthur hated to interrupt him. That's the spoon I was eating with, he said. Right, said Ford. Imagine this spoon. He found a small wooden spoon on a tray of relishes. This spoon, but found it rather tricky to pick up. No, better still, this fork. Hey, would you let go of my fork? Snapped Zaphod. All right, said Ford. All right. Why don't we say that this wine glass is the temporal universe? What, the one you just knocked on the floor? Did I do that? Yes. All right, said Ford. Forget that. I mean, look, do you know how the universe actually began, for a kickoff? Probably not, said Arthur, who wished he'd never embarked on any of this. All right, said Ford. Imagine this. Right, you get this bath. Right, large, round bath. And it's made of ebony. Where from, said Arthur. Harrods was destroyed by the Vogons. Doesn't matter. Well, so you keep saying. Listen. All right. You get this bath. See? Imagine you've got this bath, and it's ebony. And it's conical. Conical, said Arthur. What sort of... Shh, said Ford. It's conical. So what you do is, you see, you fill it with fine white sand, right? Or sugar. Fine white sand and or sugar. Anything. Doesn't matter. Sugar's fine. And when it's full, you pull the plug out. Are you listening? I'm listening. You pull the plug out, and it all just twirls away. It twirls away, you see, out of the plug hole. I see. You don't see. You don't see at all. I haven't got to the clever bit yet. You want to hear the clever bit? Tell me the clever bit. I'll tell you the clever bit. Ford thought for a moment, trying to remember what the clever bit was. The clever bit, he said, is this. You film it happening. Clever, agreed Arthur. You get a movie camera and you film it happening. Clever. That's not the clever bit. This is the clever bit. I remember now that this is the clever bit. The clever bit is that you then thread the film in the projector backwards. Backwards? Yes, threading it backwards is definitely the clever bit. So then you just sit and watch it, and everything just appears to spiral upwards out of the plug hole and fill the bath. See? And that's how the universe began, is it? Said Arthur. No, said Ford, but it's a marvellous way to relax. He reached for his wine glass. Where's my wine glass? He said. It's on the floor. Ah. Tipping back his chair to look for it, Ford collided with the small green waiter who was approaching the table, carrying a portable telephone. Ford excused himself to the waiter, explaining that it was because he was extremely drunk. The waiter said that was quite all right and that he perfectly understood. Ford thanked the waiter for his kind indulgence, attempted to tug his forelock, missed by 6 inches, and slid under the table. Mr. Zaphod Beeblebrox, inquired the waiter. Yeah, said Zaphod, glancing up from his third steak. There is a phone call for you.
Hey, what?
A phone call, sir.
For me? Here? Hey, but I mean, who knows where I am?
One of his minds raced, the other dawdled lovingly over the food it was still shoveling in. Excuse me if I carry on, won't you? Said his eating head and carried on. There were now so many people after him, he'd lost count. He shouldn't have made such a conspicuous entrance. Hell, why not, though, he thought. How do you know you're having fun if there's no one watching you have it?
Maybe somebody tipped off the Galactic Police, said Trillian. Everyone saw you come in. You mean they want to arrest me over the phone? Said Zaphod. Could be. I'm a pretty dangerous dude when I'm cornered.
Yeah, said a voice from under the table. You go to pieces so fast people get hit by the shrapnel.
Hey, what is this, Judgment Day? Snapped Zaphod.
Do we get to see that as well? Asked Arthur nervously.
I'm in no hurry, muttered Zaphod.
Okay, so who's the cat on the phone?
He kicked forward. "Hey, get up there, kid," he said to him. "I may need you." "I am not," said the waiter, personally acquainted with the metal gentleman in question, sir.
"Metal?"
"Yes, sir."
"Did you say metal?"
Yes, sir. I said that I am not personally acquainted with the metal gentleman in question.
Okay, carry on.
But I am informed that he has been awaiting your return for a considerable number of millennia. It seems that you left here somewhat precipitately.
Left here? Said Zayford. Are you being strange? We only just arrived here.
Indeed, sir, persisted the waiter doggedly. But before you arrived here, sir, I understand that you left here. Zayford tried this in one brain and then in the other.
"You're saying," he said, "that before we arrived here, we left here?"
"This, sir, is going to be a long night," thought the waiter.
"Precisely, sir," he said. "Put your analysts on danger money, baby," advised Zayford. "No, wait a minute," said Ford, emerging above table level again. "Where exactly is here?"
"But to be absolutely exact, sir, it is the Frogstar World B."
"But we just left there," protested Zayford. "We left there and came to the restaurant at the end of the universe."
"Yes, sir," said the waiter, feeling that he was now into the home stretch and running well. "The one was constructed on the ruins of the other."
"Oh," said Arthur brightly. "You mean we've travelled in time but not in space?" "Listen, you semi-evolved simian," cut in Zayford. "Go climb a tree, will you?" Arthur bristled. "Go bang your heads together, Four Eyes," he advised Zayford.
"No, no," the waiter said to Zayford. "Your monkey has got it right, sir." Arthur stuttered in fury and said nothing apposite or indeed coherent.
"You jumped forward, I believe, 576,000,000,000 years, while staying in exactly the same place," explained the waiter. He smiled. He had a wonderful feeling that he'd finally won through against what seemed to be insuperable odds. "That's it," said Zephyr. "I got it. I told the computer to send us to the nearest place to eat. That's exactly what it did. Give or take 576,000,000,000 years or whatever, we never moved. Neat."
They all agreed that this is very neat.
"But who," said Zephyr, "is the cat on the phone?"
"Whatever happened to Marvin?" said Trillian.
Zephyr clapped his hands to his head. "The paranoid android! I left him moping about on Frogstar B."
"When was this?"
"Well, 576,000,000,000 years ago, I suppose," said Zayford. "Hey, hand me the rat rod plate, Captain."
The little waiter's eyebrows wandered about his forehead in confusion. "I beg your pardon, sir?"
"The phone, waiter," said Zayford, grabbing it off him. "She, you guys are so unhip, it's a wonder your bums don't fall off."
Indeed, sir."
"Hey, Marvin, is that you?" said Zayford into the phone. "How you doing, kid?"
There was a long pause before a thin, low voice came up the line.
"I think you ought to know I'm feeling very depressed," it said.
Zayford cupped his hand over the phone.
"It's Marvin," he said.
"Hey, Marvin," he said into the phone again. "We're having a great time. Food, wine, a little personal abuse, and the universe going foom. Where can we find you?"
Again the pause.
"You don't have to pretend to be interested in me, you know,"
said Marvin at last.
"I know perfectly well I'm only a menial robot."
"Okay, okay," said Zayford, "but where are you?"
"Reverse primary thrust, Marvin. That's what they say to me. Open airlock number 3, Marvin. Marvin, can you pick up that piece of paper?" "Can I pick up that piece of paper? Here I am, brain the size of a planet, and they ask me to..."
"Yeah, yeah,"
sympathized Zayford hardly at all.
"But I'm quite used to being humiliated,"
droned Marvin.
"I can even go and stick my head in a bucket of water, if you like. Would you like me to go and stick my head in a bucket of water? I've got one ready. Wait a minute."
Hey, Marvin,"
interrupted Zayford, but it was too late. Sad little clunks and gurgles came up the line.
"What's he saying?" asked Trillian.
Nothing," said Zayford. "He just phoned up to wash his head at us."
"There,"
said Marvin, coming back on the line and bubbling a bit.
"I hope that gave satisfaction."
Yeah, said Zayford. "Now, will you please tell us where you are?"
"I'm in the car park,"
said Marvin.
"The car park?" said Zayford. "What are you doing there?"
"Parking cars. What else does one do in a car park?"
"Okay, hang in there. We'll be right down."
In one movement, Zayford leapt to his feet, threw down the phone and wrote "Hot Black Desiato" on the bill.
"Come on, guys," he said. "Marvin's in the car park. Let's get on down."
"What's he doing in the car park?" said Arthur.
"Parking cars, what else, dum-dum?"
"But what about the end of the universe? We'll miss the big moment."
I've seen it. It's rubbish, said Zaphod. Nothing but a gnab gib.
A what?
Opposite of a big bang. Come on, let's get zappy. Few of the other diners paid them any attention as they weaved their way through the restaurant to the exit. Their eyes were riveted on the horror of the skies. An interesting effect to watch for, Max was telling them, is in the upper left-hand quadrant of the sky, where if you look very carefully, you'll see the star system Hastramel boiling away into the ultraviolet. Anyone here from Hastramel? There are one or two slightly hesitant cheers from somewhere at the back. Well, said Max, beaming cheerfully at them, it's too late to worry about whether you left the gas on now.
Chapter 18. The main reception foyer was almost empty, but Ford nevertheless weaved his way through it. Zaphod grasped him firmly by the arm and manoeuvred him into a cubicle standing to one side of the entrance hall. What are you doing to him? Asked Arthur.
Sobering him up, said Zaphod, and pushed a coin into a slot. Lights flashed, gases swirled.
Hi, said Ford, stepping out a moment later. Where are we going?
Down to the car park, come on.
What about the personnel time teleport, said Ford.
Get us straight back to the Heart of Gold.
Yeah, but I've cooled on that ship. Zani Whip can have it. I don't want to play his games. Let's see what we can find.
A Sirius Cybernetics Corporation, happy vertical people transporter, took them down deep into the substrata beneath the restaurant. They were glad to see it had been vandalized and didn't try to make them happy as well as take them down. At the bottom of the shaft, the lift doors opened and a blast of cold, stale air hit them. The first thing they saw on leaving the lift was a long concrete wall with over 50 doors in it, offering lavatory facilities for all of 50 major life forms. Nevertheless, like every car park in the galaxy throughout the entire history of car parks, this car park smelt predominantly of impatience. They turned a corner and found themselves on a moving catwalk that traversed a vast cavernous space that stretched off into the dim distance. It was divided off into bays, each of which contained a spaceship belonging to one of the diners upstairs, some smallish and utilitarian mass production models, others vast shining limo ships, the playthings of the very rich. Zaphod's eyes sparkled with something that may or may not have been avarice as he passed over them. In fact, it's best to be clear on this point. Avarice is definitely what it was. There he is, said Trillian. Marvin, down there.
They looked where she was pointing. Dimly they could see a small metal figure listlessly rubbing a small rag on one remote corner of a giant silver sun cruiser. At short intervals along the moving catwalk, wide transparent tubes led down to the floor level. Zaphod stepped off the catwalk into one of these and floated gently downwards. The others followed. Thinking back to this later, Arthur thought it was the single most enjoyable experience of his travels in the galaxy.
"Hey, Marvin," said Zaphod, striding over towards him. "Hey, kid, are we pleased to see you?"
Marvin turned, and insofar as it is possible for a totally inert metal face to look reproachful, this is what it did.
"No, you're not," he said. "No one ever is."
"Ah, suit yourself," said Zaphod, and turned away to ogle the ships. Ford went with him.
Only Trillian and Arthur actually went up to Marvin.
"No, really we are," said Trillian, and patted him in a way that he disliked intensely. "Hanging around waiting for us all this time."
576,003,579 years, said Marvin. "I counted them."
"Well, we're here now," said Trillian, feeling quite correctly in Marvin's view that it was a slightly foolish thing to say.
"The first 10 million years were the worst," said Marvin, "and the second 10 million, they were the worst too. The third 10 million I didn't enjoy at all. After that I went into a bit of a decline."
He paused just long enough to make them feel they ought to say something, and then interrupted.
"It's the people you meet in this job that really get you down,"
he said, and paused again. Trillian cleared her throat.
"Is that—"
"The best conversation I had was over 40 million years ago,"
continued Marvin. Again the pause.
"Oh dear—"
"And that was with a coffee machine."
He waited.
"Well, that's a—"
"You don't like talking to me, do you?"
said Marvin in a low, desolate tone. Trillian talked to Arthur instead.
Further down the chamber, Ford Prefect had found something of which he very much liked the look, several such things, in fact.
"Zaphod," he said in a quiet voice, "just look at some of these little star trolleys."
Zaphod looked and liked.
The craft they were looking at was in fact pretty small, but extraordinary and very much a rich kid's toy. It was not much to look at. It resembled nothing so much as a paper dart about 20 feet long, made of thin but tough metal foil. At the rear end was a small horizontal two-man cockpit. It had a tiny charm drive engine, which was not capable of moving it at any great speed. The thing it did have, however, was a heat sink. The heat sink had a mass of some 2,000 billion tons and was contained within a black hole mounted in an electromagnetic field situated halfway along the length of the ship. And this heat sink enabled the craft to be maneuvered within a few miles of a yellow sun, there to catch and ride the solar flares that burst out from its surface. Flare riding is one of the most exotic and exhilarating sports in existence, and those who can dare and afford to do it are amongst the most lionized men in the galaxy. It is also, of course, stupefyingly dangerous, and those who don't die riding invariably die of sexual exhaustion at one of the Daedalus Club's après flare parties. Ford and Zaphod looked and passed on.
"And this baby," said Ford, "the Tangerine Star Buggy with the black sunbusters."
Again, the Star Buggy was a small ship, a totally misnamed one, in fact, because the one thing it couldn't manage was interstellar distances. Basically, it was a sporty planet hopper, dolled up to look like something it wasn't. Nice lines, though. They passed on. The next one was a big one, and 30 yards long, a coach-built limo ship, and obviously designed with one aim in mind, that of making the beholder sick with envy. The paintwork and accessory detail clearly said, "Not only am I rich enough to afford this ship, I am also rich enough not to take it seriously." It was wonderfully hideous.
"Just look at it," said Zaphod. "Multi-cluster quark drive, Perspulex running boards. Gotta be a Laszlo Lyricon custom job."
He examined every inch.
"Yes," he said, "look, the infra-pink lizard album on the neutrino cowling. Laszlo's trademark. The man has no shame." "I was passed by one of these mothers once up by the Axel Nebula," said Ford. "I was going flat out, and this thing just strolled past me, star drive hardly ticking over. Just incredible."
Zaphod whistled appreciatively.
10 seconds later," said Ford, "it smashed straight into the third moon of Jaglan Beta."
"Yeah, right?
Amazing looking ship, though. Looks like a fish, moves like a fish, steers like a cow."
Ford looked around the other side.
"Hey, come see," he called out. "There's a big mural painted on this side, a bursting sun. Disaster Area's trademark. This must be Hot Black's ship, lucky old bugger. They do this terrible song, you know, which ends with a stunt ship crashing into the sun. Meant to be an amazing spectacle. Expensive in stunt ships, though."
Zaphod's attention, however, was elsewhere. His attention was riveted on the ship standing next to Hot Black Desiato's limo. His mouths hung open.
"That," he said, "that is really bad for the eyes."
Ford looked. He too stood astonished. It was a ship of classic, simple design, like a flattened salmon. 20 yards long, very clean, very sleek. There was just one remarkable thing about it.
"It's so black," said Ford Prefect. "You can hardly make out its shape. Light just seems to fall into it."
Zaphod said nothing. He had simply fallen in love. The blackness of it was so extreme that it was almost impossible to tell how close you were standing to it.
"Your eyes just slide off it,"
said Ford in wonder. It was an emotional moment. He bit his lip.
Zaphod moved forward to it, slowly, like a man possessed, or more accurately, like a man who wanted to possess. His hand reached out to stroke it.
His hand stopped. His hand reached out to stroke it again. His hand stopped again.
"Hey, come and feel the surface," he said in a hushed voice.
Ford put his hand out to feel it. His hand stopped.
You can't," he said. "See," said Zaphod, "it's just totally frictionless. This must be one mother of a mover."
He turned to look at Ford seriously. At least one of his heads did. The other stayed gazing in awe at the ship.
"What do you reckon, Ford?" he said.
"You mean, Ford looked over his shoulder. "You mean, stroll off with it? You think we should?"
"No. Nor do I. But we're going to, aren't we?"
How can we not? They gazed a little longer, till Zaphod suddenly pulled himself together. We better shift soon, he said. In a moment or so the universe will have ended, and all the captain creeps will come pouring down here to find their bourgemobiles.
Zaphod, said Ford.
Yeah?
How do we do it?
Ah, simple, said Zaphod. He turned. Marvin, he called. Slowly, laboriously, and with a million little clanking and creaking noises that he had learned to simulate, Marvin turned round to answer the summons.
Come on over here, said Zaphod. We've got a job for you.
Marvin trudged towards them.
I won't enjoy it,
he said. Yes, you will, enthused Zaphod. There's a whole new life stretching out ahead of you.
Oh, not another one,
groaned Marvin.
Look, will you shut up and listen, hissed Zaphod. This time there's going to be excitement and adventure and really wild things.
Sounds awful.
Marvin, all I'm trying to ask you...
I suppose you want me to open the spaceship for you.
What? Yeah, that's right, said Zaphod jumpily. He was keeping at least 3 eyes on the entrance. Time was short.
Well, I wish you'd just tell me rather than trying to engage my enthusiasm, said Marvin, because I haven't got one.
He walked on up to the ship, touched it, and a hatchway swung open. Ford and Zaphod stared at the opening.
Don't mention it, said Marvin. Oh, you didn't.
He trudged away again. Arthur and Trillian clustered round. What's happening? Asked Arthur.
Look at this, said Ford. Look at the interior of this ship.
Weirder and weirder, breathed Zaphod.
It's black, said Ford. Everything in it is just totally black.
In the restaurant, things were fast approaching the moment after which there wouldn't be any more moments. All eyes were fixed on the dome, other than those of Hot Black Desiato's bodyguard, which were looking intently at Hot Black Desiato, and those of Hot Black Desiato himself, which the bodyguard had closed out of respect. The bodyguard leaned forward over the table. Had Hot Black Desiato been alive, he would probably have deemed this a good moment to lean back or even go for a short walk. His bodyguard was not a man who improved with proximity. On account of his unfortunate condition, however, Hot Black Desiato remained totally inert.
Mr. Desiato, sir, whispered the bodyguard.
Whenever he spoke, it looked as if the muscles on either side of his mouth were clambering over each other to get out of the way.
Mr. Desiato, can you hear me?
Hot Black Desiato, quite naturally, said nothing.
Hot Black, hissed the bodyguard.
Again, quite naturally, Hot Black Desiato did not reply. Supernaturally, however, he did. On the table in front of him, a wine glass rattled, and a fork rose and tap-tap and taps. It settled on the table again. The bodyguard gave a satisfied grunt.
It's time we were going, Mr. Desiato,
muttered the bodyguard.
Don't want to get caught in the rush, not in your condition. You want to get to the next gig nice and relaxed. There was a really big audience for it, one of the best, Cacrophone, 576,002 million years ago. Had you will have been looking forward to it?
The fork rose again, paused, waggled in a non-committal sort of way, and dropped again.
Ah, come on, said the bodyguard. It's going to have been great. You knocked them cold.
The bodyguard would have given Dr. Dan's street mentioner an apoplectic attack.
The black ship going into the sun always gets them, and the new one's a beauty. Be real sorry to see it go. If we get on down there, I'll set the black ship autopilot and we'll cruise off in the limo, okay?
The fork tapped once in agreement, and the glass of wine mysteriously emptied itself. The bodyguard wheeled Hot Black Desiato's chair out of the restaurant.
And now, cried Max from the centre of the stage, the moment you've all been waiting for!
He flung his arms into the air. Behind him, the band went into a frenzy of percussion and rolling synthachords. Max had argued with them about this, but they claimed it was in their contract and that's what they would do. His agent would have to sort it out.
The skies begin to boil, he cried. Nature collapses into the screaming void. In 20 seconds' time, the universe itself will be at an end. See where the light of infinity bursts in upon us.
The hideous fury of destruction blazed about them, and at that moment a still, small trumpet sounded as from an infinite distance. Max's eyes swiveled round to glare at the band. None of them seemed to be playing a trumpet. Suddenly,
A wisp of smoke was swirling and shimmering on the stage next to him. The trumpet was joined by more trumpets. Over 500 times Max had done the show, and nothing like this had ever happened before. He drew back in alarm from the swirling smoke, and as he did so, a figure slowly materialized inside, the figure of an ancient man, bearded, robed, and wreathed in light. In his eyes were stars, and on his brow a golden crown. "What's this?" whispered Max, wild-eyed. "What's happening?" At the back of the restaurant, the stony-faced party from the Church of the Second Coming of the Great Prophet Zarquan leapt ecstatically to their feet, chanting and crying. Max blinked in amazement. He threw up his arms to the audience. "A big hand, please, ladies and gentlemen," he hollered, "for the great prophet Zarquan! He has come! Zarquan has come again!" Thunderous applause broke out as Max strode across the stage and handed his microphone to the prophet. Zarquan coughed. He peered round at the assembled gathering. The stars in his eyes twinkled uneasily. He handled the microphone with confusion. He said, "Hello? Look, I'm sorry I'm a bit late. I've had the most ghastly time, all sorts of things cropping up at the last moment. He seemed nervous with the expectant, awed hush. He cleared his throat. How are we for time?" he said. "Have I just got a..." And so the universe ended. Chapter 19. One of the major selling points of that wholly remarkable travel book, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, apart from its relative cheapness and the fact that it has the words "Don't Panic" written in large friendly letters on its cover, is its compendious and occasionally accurate glossary. The statistics relating to the geosocial nature of the universe, for instance, are deftly set out between pages 938,324 and 938,326. And the simplistic style in which they are written is partly explained by the fact that the editors, having to meet a publishing deadline, copied the information off the back of a packet of breakfast cereal, hastily embroidering it with a few footnotes in order to avoid prosecution under the incomprehensibly tortuous galactic copyright laws. It is interesting to note that a later and wilier editor sent the book backwards in time through a temporal warp and then successfully sued the breakfast cereal company for infringement of the same laws. Here is a sample. The universe. Some information to help you live in it. 1. Area. Infinite. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy offers this definition of the word infinite. Infinite. Bigger than the biggest thing ever and then some. Much bigger than that, in fact. Really amazingly immense. A totally stunning size. I mean, real, wow, that's big time. Infinity is just so big that by comparison, bigness itself looks really titchy. Gigantic multiplied by colossal multiplied by staggeringly huge is the sort of concept we're trying to get across here. 2. Imports. None. It is impossible to import things into an infinite area, there being no outside to import things in from. 3. Exports. None. See imports. 4. Population. None. It is known that there are an infinite number of worlds simply because there is an infinite amount of space for them to be in. However, not every one of them is inhabited. Therefore, there must be a finite number of inhabited worlds. Any finite number divided by infinity is as near to nothing as makes no odds. So the average population of all the planets in the universe can be said to be zero. From this it follows that the population of the whole universe is also zero, and any people you may meet from time to time are merely the products of a deranged imagination. 5. Monetary units. None. In fact, there are 3 freely convertible currencies in the galaxy, but none of them count. The Altarian dollar has recently collapsed, the Flanian pobblebead is only exchangeable for other Flanian pobblebeads, and the Triganic pew has its own very special problems. Its exchange rate of 8 ningis to 1 pew is simple enough, but since a ningi is a triangular rubber coin 6,800 miles along each side, no one has ever collected enough to own 1 pew. Ningis are not negotiable currency, because the galactic banks refuse to deal in fiddling small change. From this basic premise, it is simple to prove that the galactic banks are also the product of a deranged imagination. 6. Art. None. The function of art is to hold the mirror up to nature, and there simply isn't a mirror big enough. See point 1. 7. Sex. None.
Well, in fact, there is an awful lot of this, largely because of the total lack of money, trade, banks, art, or anything else that might keep all the non-existent people of the universe occupied. However, it is not worth embarking on a long discussion of it now, because it really is terribly complicated. For further information, see Guide Chapters 7, 9, 10, 11, 14, 16, 17, 19, 21 to 84 inclusive, and in fact, most of the rest of the guide.
End of side 3.